So today I'm going to talk about something that's a little bit different from the kind of interpretations we've been talking about so far. What I want to talk about is Copenhagenish interpretations. So I want to talk about basically the anti-realist option. Now you can sort of divide people into two camps, right? So somebody who's a scientific realist thinks that this kind of idea is obviously wrong. And they think it's wrong for, very obvious reasons. If it is wrong, though, what I want to show is that it's wrong for very subtle reasons, not obvious ones. And then there are those people who think that this idea is a kind of idea is obviously true, and they often don't realize just how radical the idea has to be in order to be compatible with what we know about quantum theory. So, we've been talking about realist foundations of quantum theory. We've seen that there's problems with those kinds of interpretations. So, we ought to really try to understand what the alternative is, right? And it's a lot more subtle than people often think. Okay, so by the way, this is going to be a fairly wordy lecture. If you're the kind of person who likes to see a lot of equations flying around, I hope I apologize for that. But we have to get into sort of quite a lot of definitions and things like that. Okay, the first claim I want to make is that there is no Copenhagen interpretation. Now, Copenhagen interpretation is normally supposed to refer to the views of a subset of the founders of quantum theory, those who hung out in Copenhagen, people like Bohr and Heisenberg and Pauli and people like that. Now, if you go away and read their papers that they wrote on interpretations, you won't find a coherent view in there. You'll find conflicting and slightly contradictory views. Sometimes the same author contradicts himself in the same paper. So it's not entirely clear what this view is supposed to be. In particular, Niels Bohr's views are the most closely associated with this word. But if you've ever tried to read his papers, he is very, very famous for using extremely flowery and difficult to understand language. They're notoriously difficult to read, and so there's a game that goes on in some certain sections of the quantum foundations community, which is to write papers which say this is what Niels Bohr really meant to say, and they're very different and contradictory. There's also some issues in the foundations of quantum theory, which more or less came up a fairly long time after Niels Bohr. So they weren't even fully formulated. So you won't find clear statements in his writings on any of those things. In particular, one thing that I find remarkable is in reading his papers, I only know of one paper. It's his response to the EPR paper. There's only one paper that I know of in which he even mentions the idea of a quantum state. Like, he almost never talks about the actual quantum formalism. So it's very unclear where he stood on these kind of issues. As a brief historical note, I will note that Don Howard has argued that the idea that there's something called a unified Copenhagen interpretation was invented by Heisenberg in the mid-1950s as a kind of PR campaign for Copenhagen. Before that time, people didn't speak of some kind of unified interpretation. They just talked about there were ideas that were sort of in the Copenhagen spirit. Right? So it's sort of clear that there were a collection of ideas floating around. Nobody claimed that that was a coherent and fully formed and finished interpretation. Okay, so in the intervening years, of course, many, many interpretations of quantum mechanics have appeared. Quite a few of them are inspired by this Copenhagen type of spirit and are much more sort of fully fleshed out. So I call those Copenhagenish interpretations. And here's a list of some of them, original Copenhagen, of course. And then I've sort of focused on some modern ones which people are discussing today, discussing and writing about today. We can more or less divide these interpretations into two classes, and this distinction is going to be important, and I'll explain it in more detail. But there are what I would call objective Copenhagenish interpretations, And they say something like, you know, when somebody makes a measurement, there's an objective fact of the matter about what they see. That's just a fact about the universe. You go make a measurement, there's a fact about what you've seen. Fairly straightforward. Then there's this perspectival class, which, so the word perspectival means that there are several truths. There's not one unique truth, and what's true depends on your perspective, right? So what's true, whether particular measurements have definite outcomes or not, depends on where you are sitting to some extent. Okay, this is kind of quite a radical version of Copenhagen. So as I said, I'm not really interested in trying to formulate exactly what Niels Bohr thought. What I'm interested in is what are coherent sets of ideas. And so what I'm going to try and do is try to formulate what's common to all of these interpretations, what distinguishes them, and then we can talk about that. So where I'm going by the end of this lecture is I hope to show you a recent result by Frauscheiger and Renner. And this is a theorem that they've proved that I think should be understood as ruling out the objective Copenhagen interpretations. Right? So all of these are basically dead. The people who subscribe to them will have to shift their opinion to something that's in this column. Now, if you read the paper, you won't find anything like that claimed in the paper. As I told you when we were talking about the Kolbeck-Renner theorem, Renato Renner likes to write his papers in a way that antagonizes Bohmians. So they write that any single world interpretation of quantum theory is wrong. Okay, but really, I think my understanding of this result, it should be targeted primarily at the Copenhagenish interpretations. Okay, so what I'm going to present is quite different from what's in this paper. It's a version that's due to Louis Massanes. And the only evidence I have for that is a comment thread on the internet. That version has never been published. And I'm also greatly indebted in my analysis to Matt Pusey, who gave a talk about this last summer. Here's the link to the talk. Okay, so what I want to say is that the fact that this theorem exists, even though it's not a particularly difficult theorem, is truly remarkable in my view. Because Copenhagen interpretations being anti-realist are usually completely immune to any no-go theorem you throw at them. Remember, all of the theorems that we talked about in the ontological models framework, we always start by saying, let's assume systems have some objective physical properties, lambda. And then a Copenhagenist will say, well, that's obviously the assumption that's wrong. Forget about that. Systems don't have those ontic states. So, Yabu sucks to you. Your theorems are a load of rubbish. So it's actually extremely unusual to be able to place constraint. How can you place a constraint on a theory which really says very little is real? Right? It's a very hard thing to do. So this, I think, is sort of a genuinely new development. Okay, so we have to understand what these Copenhagenish interpretations are. And I think that there are four common features. And I will go through each one and explain. Now, in order to prove the Frauscheiger-Renner theorem is not quite enough, I need an extra constraint, which, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure what the best way of formulating it is. So this is kind of like new ideas. But I think, anyway, the basic idea of it would be something that most Copenhagenists think would be fairly reasonable. All right, so I would need to go through these four principles. Okay, so let's talk about the first one. The first one I call observers observe. Also, I could call it no solipsism. So the idea is the following. So when I think about my own experience of the world, I know that I am the type of entity that when I do a quantum measurement, I experience a definite outcome. That's something that's in my experience. To be honest, I'm a theorist, so I haven't actually done a quantum experiment since I was an undergraduate. But I'm at least assuming that if I did do one, that would still hold true. Okay. Now, this is the no solipsism part, right? I see around here lots of entities that seem fairly similar to me, right? other humans in this lecture theater, graduate students. I posit that those similar entities have the same experience that I do, right? So if I were to send you over to IQC to do a quantum experiment, you would see a definite outcome in the measurement, and I'm not questioning that that's what happens, okay? That's a fact, okay?
So can I
just, yeah.
What would be the, well, if someone wouldn't agree with that, what would they say?
Well, I mean, you could, for example, be a solipsist, as Joe Emerson was talking about the other day, and just say, I only believe that my own experience exists, for instance, right? Or you could say, well, I mean, that's the main alternative to that, I would suggest. Okay, so bear in mind that I'm only posing this as a sufficient condition, not a necessary one. So I'm not trying to claim that you need consciousness, human observers, or anything like that in order for something definite to occur, right? You could accept a decoherence account. You could say, for example, I think definite things occur when there's sufficient decoherence, for instance, right? That would be fine. It's only that I'm making an observation that it's certainly sufficient for this to happen. I know it happens for me, I assume you're like me, etc. Okay, so exactly how you cash out, how observations occur, doesn't really matter. We only just have this sufficient condition. So we can divide this into two versions, the objective version and the perspectival version. This is where the two kinds of Copenhagen differ. In the objective version, when you make a measurement and observe the result, then that's an objective fact about the universe. Okay? Doesn't matter if I'm still standing here and haven't seen the result of the experiment. If I send you over to IQC, you make that observation, you record the result, that's a fact about the universe, regardless of whether I know it. Okay. Then there's a perspectival version which says, when you make a measurement and observe the result, then those are facts for you. Okay, so remember, each observer can have their own perspective, which has its own truths in it. Okay. There won't be a fact of the matter for me about whether that exists and what it is, unless I go to the lab myself and repeat the measurement immediately after you, or ask you what the result was. Okay, have to interact either with you or the physical system in order for that to become a truth, something real for me. Okay, so you can see that this is a much more sort of radical kind of point of view. Okay, so that's principle one. Principle two is universality. And this basically says that quantum theory is a fundamental physical theory. I believe that the Copenhagen founders thought that, right? They weren't thinking, you know, they were thinking that they found a new fundamental physical theory, not some sort of effective thing, right? So what does this mean? If we believe it's universal, if we really believe it's really the fundamental theory, then anything in the universe, so that desk there if I want, or even I can apply quantum theory to you if I want to do that, anything in the universe can in principle be described by quantum theory. There's a subtlety, which is we might find that we can describe any system, but not absolutely everything at the same time. But in principle, there's no system in the universe which can't be described by quantum theory. In other words, there's nothing that's like a fundamentally classical or non-quantum system in the universe. So this means that I, in principle, I can arrange a situation in which I would describe the state of a graduate student as a superposition of macroscopically distinct states, because if I decide to describe you making a measurement entirely quantum mechanically, then that's what I would write down, okay? This makes Copenhagenism not the same as operationalism, okay? It's not operationalism, because in operationalism, you have an undefined primitive of what's a measurement, when does a measurement occur, that you have to put in by hand, okay? Let's say, look, you know, maybe we don't exactly know what measurements are, but I'm gonna say there's this thing called measurement, right? In the regard of universality, the idea that this is the fundamental theory, this is a similar position to Everett, although, of course, this is going to be a very anti-realist position, but it shares that thing, one thing in common. So that's number two. Okay, so before we move on to number three, you might think that there's already a problem here. You might think that, well, the measurement problem, doesn't that already rule out the combination of these two things? Right? Because universality implies that I can describe a measurement like this, including the person doing the measurement in this superposition if I like. But from the point of view of an observer who's actually done that observation, because I'm saying that observers definitely do observe, they're necessarily going to describe the spin after the measurement as one of these two. So those two things together imply that there must be situations in which two different descriptions of the quantum system apply. But remember, in the measurement problem, this is only directly a problem if you already believe that quantum states are objective ontic states, right? Or if you assume something like the eigenvalue eigenstate link and these two things represent different properties. So third principle is just we don't believe that. Okay, so all Copenhagenish interpretations are anti-psiontic in some way. I just want to note here that I would be happy to say that they're psi-epistemic. I would be happy with that terminology. But when I talk to various Copenhagen advocates who like different words, they always say, oh, no, this is not psi-epistemic. You know, like, it's what I mean by psi-epistemic. But basically, if you go through the Copenhagenish papers, you'll find various words, right? They'll say things like, and these are all taken from actual papers, actual interpretations, they'll say things like, the quantum state represents our knowledge, our information, our beliefs, what we can say. This is actually a Niels Bohr quote here, or advice about the quantum system, depending on which Copenhagenish view you're talking about. But all that matters for me is that they're not psiontic, right? So that's what I'm going to say, it's anti-psiontic. So if you believe that, then two different descriptions of a measurement needn't necessarily be contradictory. Right? They don't necessarily describe a different reality. They could, for example, represent the descriptions of two different observers who happen to have access to different information, for instance. Okay, so there's the observer who's actually seen the outcome of the measurement, who might use this description, and the observer who's outside the lab might use that description. Okay, so that's principle three. Principle four, anti-realism. Now, this is what distinguishes it from a realist psi-epistemic interpretation, such as the Speck and Sploy theory type of idea. So they say further, you know, quantum theory is the fundamental theory, right? There's no deeper description to be had. No ontic states. When you describe a system quantum mechanically, you're not allowed to give it an ontic state, right? That's it. That's all there is, just this state of knowledge or belief or information, whatever. Now, there are two reasons for this. One is you might think, well, quantum systems actually do have properties, but there's just no way of describing those properties in the quantum formalism. Right? So I call this ineffability. The word ineffable means that something is impossible to talk about. The word actually comes from theology. People say things like, the mind of God is ineffable, right? There's something that's just impossible for a human being to grasp or understand in any way. So it means it's literally impossible to talk about these properties. So to use Einstein's analogy, we would say that, you know, well, perhaps the moon is there when nobody is looking, but it's fundamentally impossible to describe that in language, pictures, mathematics, computer code, anything that you might try to write down or communicate. So that's possibility one. I regard that as a little bit more appealing than possibility two, which would be to say that quantum systems literally have no properties, right? So if I'm describing the moon quantum mechanically, then it literally isn't there when nobody's looking. So if you want to go for an objective Copenhagenish interpretation, it's necessary to take this point of view. Why? Because if I can describe an observer as being in a macroscopic superposition, but at the same time I believe they've observed a definite outcome, then I'm ascribing a property to the system, the observer, right? He has a property that I believe exists, right? So I can't say that quantum systems have no properties, all I can say is that those properties aren't present in my description. Okay? That's necessary if you're an objective Copenhagenish. Option two can be made to sound more perspectival, right? So instead of talking about properties relative to nothing, I can talk about systems having properties for me, systems having properties for you, and so forth. So you might, a perspectivalist might say something like this. They might say, well, for me, the moon has no properties, and I'm not looking at it, but it might have properties for you. If you happen to be looking at the moon, you might be able to say that there are properties for you. There are just no properties for me. In either case, we can't say that quantum states represent knowledge, information, or whatever about some underlying state of reality, as we would in a realist psi epistemic interpretation. The only thing we can say is that they represent information, for example, about the outcomes of future measurements that we might make. So when we do decide to interact with the quantum system, that knowledge or information becomes information about what we will see in that interaction. Okay, so those are the four, yeah.
Can we just go back to the other slide? I don't really see how number one is anti-realist. Like, if the moon is there, stuff exists.
Well, I mean, anti-scientific realism really just says that our scientific theories aren't directly about reality. It doesn't necessarily imply that there's no reality. Right. Just says you can either think there's reality or no reality, but you're just sort of saying, well, that's irrelevant to the interpretation of my scientific theory. I don't interpret my scientific theory as being about that.
But is it about, like, that specific scientific theory or any scientific theory?
Anti-realism in general is about any scientific theory, but you could be anti-realist about quantum theory and realist about other scientific theories if you like. Nothing stopping you doing that. Yeah.
To what extent does this allow for, like, an indirect observation? Like, what if I'm not looking at the moon, but my friend's looking at the moon, takes a picture of the moon and shows it to me? Like,
yeah. So, you know, I said earlier that when I was talking about observers observe, that one way, in the perspectival version anyway, one way in which something can become real for me is if I talk to you, right? Mm-hmm. So if you made a measurement and then we subsequently talk about it, then most Copenhagenists would say, well, even if they're perspectival, would say, okay, at that moment it becomes real for me as well. Okay. So yes, it can be indirect. Okay, so I would like to say that these four principles are not contradictory, but they are certainly in a certain amount of tension with one another. Let's see why. So if universality is true, then I can describe another observer, you, making measurements by this pure state, okay? But if anti-realism is true, then the very fact that I've decided to model you quantum mechanically means that I cannot ascribe you any properties when I describe you this way. If I decide to make you, give you a quantum mechanical description, there's no way I can assign you properties. So in particular, if I want to account for my own observations, if I want to account for the fact that I have observed something, then that means that I'm ascribing a property to myself. Okay? So that means that necessarily I cannot include myself in my quantum descriptions, at least if I want to account for the fact that what I actually see. So therefore, in order to do this, you necessarily have to split the world into two parts, right? So you may have heard that in Copenhagen we have to split the world into a quantum part and a classical part, and you might have thought that's a posit of the Copenhagen interpretation. It's not really a posit of the Copenhagen interpretation. It's derived from the principles of the Copenhagen interpretation. A bit like in Everett, many worlds are not posited. They're derived from the principles of the interpretation. Okay, so I have to split the world into two parts. One part is the part I'm going to describe quantum mechanically, and the other part is the part I'm going to exclude from that description because I want to be able to describe that part properties. Often this is called the classical part, but that's a bit of a misleading terminology because it's not actually important that that system obeys the equations of Newtonian mechanics or anything like that. All that's important is it's excluded from the quantum description in order to be able to assign properties to it. And the split between these two parts is usually called the Heisenberg cut. Okay, the shifty split. You have to be very careful when you're saying this, the shifty split. However, so if universality is true, I can in principle describe any quantum mechanical, any system in the universe quantum mechanically, then there can't be a fundamental place, there can't be a point at which you absolutely have to put the Heisenberg cut. There can't be a, it must be exactly here. No, you could, if universality is true, I can always include more of the universe in my quantum description. So it is a movable cut. And this terminology shifty split was due to Arthur Fine. So, you know, in most cases, where we're going to put this split is not anything fundamental. It's to be decided by pragmatic reasons. So there's always going to be a lowest level at which you can put the split, so a smallest system which you can describe quantum mechanically. Why? Because if you were to decide to do an experiment where you do sort of coherent interference experiment between degrees of freedom that you're describing in the classical part, then you would fail to get the predictions right. Okay? There's going to be a lowest level at which you can put the split and still get predictions that are in accord with the experiments you're doing. There's also a highest level, because as I've argued, you always have to put the split in front of yourself when you're talking about your own observations. Okay? So today, for instance, in modern times, this didn't exist in Bohr's time, but we might use, for example, something like decoherence theory to decide where the lowest level is. Doesn't matter if that's exactly the account you accept. The point is that there will be a lowest level to be determined somehow. In between those two, there's a range of possible levels of description, depending on where you put the cut. Okay, so the fact that so you're going to assign different quantum states depending on where you put that cut. Right? If you put it in front of a measurement device, then you'll say that the measurement has occurred, and you'll have a spin with two different outcomes. If you put it after the measurement device, you'll have a coherent superposition. Okay, but this fact doesn't bother Copenhagenists because they're not Scientologists. Right? They don't believe that these are descriptions of reality. And all that really matters is that so long as all these levels agree on the predictions for experiments that you actually perform, everything's perfectly fine. Then there's no contradiction. And you know, the definition of lowest level and highest level basically ensures that that's going to be the case. OK, so now I want to think about two observers. So what we're going to do now is start to try and make problems for these Copenhagenish interpretations. And we're going to culminate in talking about the Frauscheiger-Renner theorem. But I want to build up to it with a few different concepts. So let's suppose there are two observers, Alice and Bob. In principle, each observer will have a different range of levels that's valid for them. In particular, the highest level is different. Alice says, the highest level always has to come in front of me. Bob says, it has to always come in front of me. I can describe you as a quantum system, right? Nonetheless, you might have thought that for any two observers, if we look at what their highest level and lowest level is, that it's always possible to find a range of levels that they agree upon, okay? So this would be an example. This is Alice's lowest level and highest level, Bob's lowest level and highest level. Here, all of the levels within here are descriptions of the quantum system that they both can agree are valid, right? So if that's the case, then if that's true for all observers in the universe, then there's always some description of the quantum mechanical system which works for everybody, and we might have thought that, okay, once we've picked a level within there, everything's going to be objective, like I'll have objectively correct quantum states that assign on that level. However, if that kind of thing doesn't happen, then we have a level conflict. If it happens that Bob's highest level is lower than Alice's lower level, then there's no place where they can both place the split and agree. And what I want to claim now is that the Vigenère-Friend experiment shows that level conflicts have to happen, at least in principle, in thought experiments. The experiment is obviously very difficult to do in the lab. Yeah.
What is the height?
So, you know, the highest level is, okay, so what you're imagining is that these levels correspond to different splittings between system that I'm describing quantum mechanically and classical world, right? Yeah, so, well, okay. So if you're a Copenhagenist, you don't believe in something like the Hilbert space of the entire universe, but if we talk in those terms, in decoherence terms, it's a question of how much of the world are you putting in your system and how much are you putting in the environment. But in Copenhagen language, it's how much is described quantum mechanically, how much is not described quantum mechanically. So, I mean, you're right, it's not strictly speaking a linear thing because, you know, but, you know, that some, you could have different subsystems, different choices of subsystems. But this is just supposed to be schematic, right? The idea is when you have level agreement, there's some such description that they can both agree on. Okay. Okay, so Wigner's friend experiment, in case you haven't heard of it, it's due to Eugene Wigner. And it's just like the Schrodinger's cat experiment, very simple way of explaining it, except Wigner is going to put his friend inside a box to make a spin measurement instead of a cat. Okay. And now the only difference here is that because of the observer's observe principle that I stated earlier, because I think I definitely know that, or I definitely posit that there are other observers out there, the friend is unambiguously an observer. So we don't get into questions which people did get into with Schrodinger's cat about whether a cat can cause a collapse of the wave function or whatever, right? It's we're going to put something in the box that we unambiguously would regard as an observation. So you put whatever, you know, depending on the account, what needs to be in the box to constitute an observation will be different. So you put whatever you need in the box, whatever you think is needed to guarantee that an observation has happened. If you believe in environmental decoherence, for instance, you might say, the box also has to include a very large environment, like, you know, a thermal bath or something like that. Okay, point is, put all of that stuff inside the box, including the spin and the friend and the measurement device and so forth. Okay, so Wigner certainly can, it's within his range of levels, to put his cut outside the box. And if he does that, then he will describe, after the friend has made a measurement, a superposition state like this. However, the friend's highest level, if the friend really has made an observation, friend's highest level is always in front of herself. So she necessarily assigns one of these two states to the spin. Okay? Then we might imagine this kind of discussion. The friend says, well, come on, Wigner, you're being stupid. We want to reach level agreement, so put your cut a bit lower. Okay, then we can agree. And then Wigner says, sorry, mate. I'm contemplating doing a coherent interference experiment on you, whether I'm actually going to do it or not. And so my lowest level is above you, right? I can't possibly include you in the classical part. I'm going to interfere you with yourself. Okay. There's a level conflict here. Okay. So level conflict can happen. So here's something you might do. Here's another position you might take. You might say, okay, I know level conflicts happen in the middle of experiments, but maybe they don't happen in the long run, right? So after the whole experiment is over, in the long run future, then you might say, okay, in the long run, there will be, at the end of the experiment, a level that we can both agree upon, and within that level, we will both assign the same quantum state. Okay, so the reason you might think about this is that in the conventional Wigner's friend experiment, at some point, Wigner opens the box, finds out what his friend has measured. Okay, at that point, they're both correlated with the quantum system in the same way. They can both place the cut at the same point, and then they will both agree that it's one of these two states. So in the long run, they reach level agreement, and they reach agreement about the quantum state. Everything's fine. But this doesn't always happen. It won't happen if Wigner actually does the coherent experiment on his friend. Then disagreement ends up persisting. Now, I'm going to explain this experiment in a minute, but I like to call this experiment the Wigner's enemy experiment, because it involves Wigner erasing his friend's memory. That's a pretty nasty thing to do to a friend. So I believe that if Wigner did this experiment, the friend would become his enemy. Yeah, friends don't recohere friends is the method. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to cheat a little bit in the description, and you know, because so normally we, when we're describing a measurement, we talk about a ready state of the apparatus or whatever. But I just want to, for simplicity, describe the friend as a qubit. This is a simple model of a friend. So I'm going to assume that the friend's ready state is the same as the state in which they're seeing spin up. Okay, and the point is that the measurement has to flip her to spin down if the spin is down. Okay, so with that, we can easily give a specific, fully specified unitary interaction that implements the measurement. So the friend initially is going to be, the spin is initially going to be in a superposition of one of these two states. The whole thing will be in this sector here. And what happens is that if the spin is up, the friend continues seeing spin up. If it's down, she gets flipped. And then all I'm doing over here is saying, well, if I want a unitary interaction, I have to say how it acts on the rest of the Hilbert space. Right, but that doesn't matter for the purposes of the measurement, really. Okay, this is a unitary interaction. If you've done quantum information theory, this is basically just a C0 gate between two qubits. Nice thing about this unitary interaction is that it's its own inverse. So if Wigner can undo the measurement by applying this unitary again, and that will undo the measurement. Okay, so if Wigner does that, and he does it to this state here, then this will just go back to the state it was before the measurement. So this is what Wigner thinks happens. For the friend, we have a bit of a problem, because we said, oh, she can't include herself in a quantum description. But, you know, it's a bit funny, but, you know, she knows that she's correlated to the spin, right? So if we sort of temporarily allowed her to do that, she thinks the state is something like this, one of these two. And let's consider the case where she saw the spin-up outcome. Then in that case, she would think, well, just this happens, right? So the undoing is going to leave her state unchanged. She'll still think that it should be this. Now notice that after the measurement undoing, neither Wigner nor the friend thinks that the friend is correlated with the system in any way, right? They're in a product state. So at this point, there isn't a level conflict, right? But because of this undoing, we've ended up in a situation where Wigner and the friend assign different quantum states to the system. So that's a bit of a puzzle. Of course, as I just said, in order for the friend to compute what happens in the undoing, she needs to apply quantum mechanics to herself, which conflicts with the idea that the highest level is before herself. Okay, so we could just say that, okay, this application of quantum theory that I just did for the friend is illegitimate. Only Wigner's description can be used. This is a little bit problematic, you know, from the point of view of universality. We would expect to be able to, that any observer should be able to describe any experiment quantum mechanically in principle. And this says that there are some possible experiments that some observers simply cannot describe what happens in. That's a little bit problematic from the Feynman-Hagen point of view. So what we could do is sort of relax that slightly and say, well, in this case, the friend's application of quantum theory is okay. You know, it doesn't change the way she's correlated with the system anyway, so maybe we'll just let her do that. And then you would say, well, you know, we're anti-Scientologists after all. So we don't really even care that they end up with different pure state descriptions, even though there's no level conflict. That just represents, for example, different beliefs. This kind of attitude is true in quantum Bayesianism, where they say that quantum states represent beliefs, not objective information. So that might be OK. Anyway, the point is that there's a little bit of a difficulty here for Copenhagenish interpretation. In any case, the fact that there are different state assignments, if we interpret them in this sort of way, does not prove that objective observations do not exist, right? The quantum states do not describe the objective observations. The objective observations, if they exist, they're something else, okay? So none of this is going to rule out the objective Copenhagen point of view precisely. For that, we need to look at this Rauscheiger-Renner thing. Okay. So now let's move on to that. So for our Scheiger-Renner experiment, what is it? It's just really a mashup between the Wigner's enemy experiment and Bell's theorem, combine the two things. So here's how it works. So if you consider two systems that are prepared in the maximally entangled state. Alice is going to measure system A, Bob is going to measure system B. So as in the Bell CHSH inequality, Alice has one or two two observables she can measure on system A, and Bob has one of two observables that he can measure on system B. Let's assume that these observables have two outcomes, as in the usual Bell CHSH scenario. Now, the difference here is that we're going to consider the description of this experiment not from Alice and Bob's perspective, but from the perspective of a third party, Wigner. Right? Alice and Bob are Wigner's friends, and he's going to put this whole thing inside a box, and he can describe that whole thing unitarily. Okay? So he's going to say these measurement interactions are described by coherent unitaries. So then we note that whenever Alice and Bob measure one of these observables, Wigner can, in principle, undo it, just like in the Wigner's friend experiment. Right? If he's describing it as a coherent unitary interaction, he can apply the inverse. OK, so now this allows us to do something that we can't do in the usual Bell experiment. In the usual Bell experiment, on every run of the experiment, Alice and Bob measure one of their two observables. But now, because we have Wigner, we can have them measure both. Right? So Alice will first measure A0. Then Wigner will come in and coherently undo the interaction. And then she'll measure A1. And the same for Bob. Now, remember that those reversal unitaries will put the system back in its initial state. So whenever Alice and Bob are making a measurement, they're making a measurement which, according to Wigner, is on this quantum state in both cases. So OK, so this is maybe makes things a bit clearer. This is the experiment, OK? So this is what the experiment looks like from Wigner's point of view. You have these systems A and B. You have Alice and Bob, who are also quantum systems, according to Wigner. Then these measurements are just coherent unitary interaction. Here is a unitary that implements the A0 observable. Then Wigner undoes it, applies the inverse, and then later on, Alice does the A1 measurement. And then similarly for Bob. So that's what the experiment looks like. Okay. So now we note an implication of the objective version of Copenhagen. So according to the objective versions of Copenhagen, of the observer's observe postulate, if we believe that this thing, this thing, this thing, and this thing, if we believe that they all constitute observations, then there's a fact of the matter about what Alice and Bob observe in each of those measurements on every single run of the experiment. So in each run of the experiment, there is a fact of the matter about what the outcome of this experiment is. There's a fact of the matter about this outcome, and this one, and this one. Okay? Wigner doesn't have any means of describing them, right? But if you believe the objective version of Copenhagen, they exist nonetheless, right? They're not directly observable by anybody. All of them aren't directly observable, but they exist. So let's denote those outcomes by small letters. Okay. So now, if you were to repeat this experiment multiple times, yeah.
What if I do the inverse unitary? Doesn't that delete the outcome?
It deletes Alice's memory of the outcome. But according to the objective Copenhagen interpretation, outcomes exist and are facts. Like when an observer makes a measurement, there's a definite outcome and it's a fact about the universe. The fact that I subsequently erase Alice's memory doesn't change the fact that for that period of time, there was an objective fact of the matter. Right, so all we need is that on each run of this experiment, there's a fact of the matter about which of these outcomes exists. We don't need that there's anybody that remembers all of them. Right?
And how is that information transferred to Wigner by someone else?
Nobody knows them. Nobody knows all of them. Nobody knows all of them. It's a bit subtle. I'll explain in a bit more detail later. There's no observer who knows all of them, right? But the point of the objective view as opposed to the perspectival view is that there are still objective facts about what they are. OK, so that means that if you repeat this experiment multiple times, you could that there exists, although nobody knows it, there exists relative frequency statistics for what those things are. So that means that there is, in principle, an object I can write down, the joint probability distribution of all of those things. Like, nobody may know that joint probability distribution. The point is, it exists. Okay? Okay, so now we invoke something called Fine's theorem, which will connect this idea to the Bell inequalities. So here I've made no assumptions about locality, but it turns out that just the existence of this joint distribution is equivalent to the existence of a Bell local model. The easiest version of that to prove is to connect it to the operationalist version of the Bell theorem assumptions. So if you have an outcome deterministic and parameter independent model for a Bell experiment, that's equivalent to the existence of a joint probability distributions over all of the observables in the experiment that gives you the correct marginals, the same marginals as the parameter independent model. So we actually only need the converse part, right? So we have the joint probability distribution. I want to connect it to a Bell local model. So how do you do that? Well, you simply let your hidden variable be a specification of all the four outcomes. Okay? You can do that. And then I have this joint probability distribution that exists, so I'm just going to set my lambda probabilities to be the things that come from that joint probability distribution. And then the local deterministic, so these specify, remember that in a deterministic model, there's just a function of the ontic state that tells me what the outcome is. So I choose to measure observable 0 or 1, then I'm just going to have my probability read off either A0 or A1 and tell me what it is, assign probability 1 to that outcome. And similarly for B. So then if you write down what the predictions for this parameter-independent model would be, they're the same as just taking the marginal over the corresponding two observables. It's very easy to see. When I sum over lambda here, I have to sum over all of A0, A1, B0, and B1. But there's a delta function on AX, so I'm going to pick out that term. And there's a delta function on BY, so I'm going to pick out that term. So you just get the marginal. OK. So since there exists a local model in this sense, we know that that model would satisfy the Bell inequalities. So that means that this joint probability distribution, if I look at its marginals over every pair of Alice Bob marginals, those things will satisfy the CHSH inequality in particular. But we know that the quantum predictions do not satisfy them. But here's the get out, right? As was pointed out earlier, there's never anybody who knows all of these outcomes at the same time. Right? So there's never anybody who can check whether they all satisfy the quantum predictions. So we conclude from the Bell result that at least one of these four marginals has to fail to agree with the quantum predictions. Otherwise, a joint probability distribution wouldn't exist. And so then we can ask the question, well, which of these marginals absolutely have to obey the quantum predictions on pain of falsifying quantum mechanics? Okay. And the answer to that question is, well, it depends on how Wigner decides to perform the experiment. So if Wigner performs the experiment in such a way that a certain pair of outcomes persists for a very long time, such that Alice and Bob could get together and talk about what their outcomes are, they could discuss them and write a Nature paper about them, et cetera, then if their marginals fail to obey the quantum predictions, quantum theory would be falsified. Yes?
Wouldn't like this discussion between them be like an interaction?
Would be an interaction. There would be a complicated unitary interaction. And so in order to undo it, Wigner would have to do a more complicated unitary.
Okay.
He'd have to do it. But remember, we're not making a locality assumption here. We just assume all this is happening inside a box, right? So Wigner has put the entire Earth, including the Nature publication offices, inside the box. And that whole thing is described by unitary. So he could still, in principle, apply a unitary that would undo everything. That's some later point. The point is, there could be a very, very long period between where the measurement is done and Wigner does the undoing. Of course, it gets harder in natural systems. It gets harder and harder for Vignette to implement that unit tree. But this is all thought experiments and points of principle here, so that doesn't matter. OK, but if you have a pair of outcomes that doesn't persist long enough for Alice and Bob to discuss them, to get together and discuss them, then you're not going to falsify quantum mechanics if it doesn't agree with the quantum prediction. So OK, so let's look at two ways of implementing the experiment. Here, big T is a very, very long period of time, right? Let's say 10 years. And let's assume that Alice and Bob are both on Earth, so that's plenty of time for them to discuss. And little t is a very, very small period of time. This doesn't matter what it is exactly. The point is here that these two outcomes persist for a very long time. And then Alice is undone, and she does A1. But that's still coexisting with B0 for a long period of time. Okay. And then at the end, there will be so these lines should continue to go up. There will be a long period of time as well at which B1 and A1 both exist. So these three marginals have to obey the quantum predictions, otherwise quantum theory would be falsified. But this one doesn't, because there's never, in this way of implementing the experiment, a period of time in which both A0 and B1 exist. Those things are, this erasure is time-like separated from this measurement. There's nobody who can see that marginal, so we can say, OK, what happens is that this one doesn't agree with the quantum predictions. So now let's consider the opposite. It's just I'm exchanging the role of Alice and Bob. In this way of implementing the experiment, it's the same kind of thing. Three of the marginals would have to obey the quantum predictions, but one of them doesn't have to. OK? So you can say, OK, that's the resolution. Depending on how you implement the experiment, I can always find at least one marginal which doesn't have to obey the quantum predictions. So you could take that, and then there will be no contradiction. So here's the sort of tricky part of the argument, which I don't fully have the best way of explaining yet, but let me give it a shot. OK, so we can't get a contradiction this way. However, I just want to note that there's really nothing in the formalism of quantum theory that would explain why it is that we get different non-quantum marginals in these two experiments. So you'd somehow have to imagine that there's some mechanism that communicates to Alice's system whether or not Bob's second measurement has happened yet and whether it's OK for the marginal to be non-quantum or not. So if we're talking about realist models, if we're talking about hidden variable models, you might say, OK, fine, there's such a mechanism that exists in the hidden variable model. Okay? We already have weird things in the hidden variable model, so that's sort of fine. But in a Copenhagen-ish quantum theory, that's supposed to be sort of just raw quantum mechanics interpreted completely anti-realistically. There's really sort of no justification for saying that these two experiments should be treated differently. So this is sort of roughly what I mean by this formalism supervenience. If you have sequences of observations that are described the same way in the quantum formalism, they ought to make the same predictions, right? They ought to make the same predictions. There's no real reason for believing that one experiment should be treated differently from the other. So if you believe that, then you would get the implications from both versions of the experiment, however you implement it, and then you would say that the marginals would have to be quantum. All the marginals would have to be the quantum in both experiments, and then we get a contradiction. Yeah.
Can you go back a slide? So why couldn't Figner undo the top two measurements, and then they could just change the orders and such that all the marginals?
Yeah. Okay, but then you're doing A0 twice, and then you would have to assume that when you measure A0, undo it, and then measure A0 again, you'd necessarily get the same result. You don't want to assume that in a Copenhagenish interpretation because that's sort of tantamount to some kind of deterministic hidden variables theory. Right? So you certainly don't want to assume that if I do a measurement, undo it, then do the measurement again, that you'll necessarily get the same result.
But aren't we saying a fact of the matter exists because when you did the first measurement?
Fact of the matter exists about what the outcome of a measurement is once it's been observed. But there's nothing in that that says if I then undo that measurement and do it again, those two facts of the matter have to be the same. In fact, that would be bad. That would make this into a hidden variables type of approach. Copenhagenists want to say that the outcome is generated by the act of observation, not predetermined in any way. Okay, so that is an important point, yeah. Okay, so if you believe something like this, then you'll get a contradiction. Now, let me motivate that a bit more. You could also do the experiment in a kind of space-like fashion. These are supposed to be, these dotted lines are supposed to be light cones. The idea being that here there are frames of reference in which all four marginals are simultaneous. Now, if you do it in this space-like way, then of course there's no question of Alice and Bob getting together to discuss their results at all, right? Because the erasure has to happen before there's a chance to do that in order for it to be space-like. Okay, so in this case, strictly speaking, only the final marginal would have to be quantum because that's the only one that persists for an arbitrary long period of time. But sort of as an intuition pump, note that what is this experiment? This experiment is just this experiment, except we made T smaller, right? Big T smaller, right? So if you reduce big T, if you just do the experiments faster than you did before, then you eventually get to that space-like setup. But if you do this experiment slightly faster, then you also get to that space-like setup, right? So what justification does a Copenhagenist have for treating this experiment differently from either of those other two? Seems like they're basically the same experiment, just done faster, right? There's no real conceptual distinction. So this you can use as a sort of intuition for why you would expect those other two experiments to have the same marginal, same predictions. Okay, so I'm going to assume that, I have had discussions with Copenhagen people about this, and they usually accept that sort of argument. So the obvious thing to do in response is to say, okay, well, what was the problem was this objectivity of outcomes. Let's switch to perspectival view, right? So you can't get the contradiction to go if you say Alice's outcomes only exist for Alice and Bob's outcomes only exist for Bob and neither exist for Vigner, right? Then there isn't a global perspective under which all of the outcomes could be said to exist, right? And that, hence, there's no joint probability distribution. So that's how, if you're perspectival, you just evade this whole argument. So I was going to spend a bit of time talking about two particular perspectival interpretations, but I think I'm going to skip that. You can read the slides later if you want. Cubism is probably the most well-known perspectival Copenhagen. After talking to Carlo Rovelli, I also realized his relational quantum mechanics is also an interpretation of this type, although I think his interpretation has more problems. That's just my opinion. So to summarize, unless we're willing to permit some sort of contortions about which marginals have to be quantum and not quantum, then Frauscheiger-Renner does rule out the objective Copenhagen interpretations, which is, you know, most of them, except for these two. These are the only two I know of. Of course, the other Copenhagenists can sort of shift their position slightly and become more perspectival, and then they'd be okay. But a lot of them don't want to do that. And it's just remarkable that we can constrain Copenhagenish interpretations in any way whatsoever. Like, no-go theorems are normally about realist interpretations. So that's interesting we can do that. I don't think the perspectival move is very appealing to a lot to some. Well, at least the large class of Copenhagenists. Why is that? Because Copenhagen interpretation is normally thought of as a sort of very level-headed and empiricist interpretation, right? It takes facts that we see in everyday life as like straightforward facts, right? There's a certain seed of operationalism in it, right? In the Copenhagen interpretation, the fact that I see a desk there is supposed to be just a fact, like a raw empirical fact, and it doesn't deny that. So this fact that it has this sort of straightforward empirical attitude that makes a lot of people prefer Copenhagen to something like Everett, right? So in Everett, it says, actually what you see is not straightforwardly true, it's true in a very complicated way, right? There's a long path to understanding how the fundamental ontology is related to what you actually see. That's only an emergent thing. So I think this kind of straightforward empiricism is what many people see as appealing in Copenhagen's like views. So in light of that, if you don't like perspectivalism, this result might drive you further towards realism. But of course, remember, we have plenty of results that make realism seem like a bad idea too. So my own personal take is in light of all of this, we should, if we're going to do realism, we should try to investigate more exotic types of ontology that can potentially get around all of the no-go results. Okay, so since this is the last lecture, I just wanted to sum up a bit. So, you know, one of my main goals was, and hopefully I've convinced you, that there is an interplay between mathematical foundations, conceptual foundations, interpretations of quantum mechanics, and in some cases, the way we actually go about doing calculations in quantum theory. At least the classical limit stuff was meant to convince you of that. My view is that these things are better done together, right? So it's not, we shouldn't take interpretations and sort of put them off to one side as a separate topic. We've seen that, in fact, there are many ways of solving the original question I posed. Right? There are many ways of providing an ontology that saves the phenomena in quantum theory. But the third criterion, which is therefore what we should be focusing on, is which one is correct, which by which I mean, by my pragmatic criterion, which one leads to progress in physics. And it's sort of fairly evident that none of these interpretations have led to dramatic progress in physics yet. So if you do decide that you want to pursue quantum foundations research, I hope this is a project that you'll contribute to. However, most people won't. Most people will do some other area of physics. And if you do that, I hope that you'll occasionally pause to ask, when you're doing quantum mechanics, to ask, well, what would a semicist think is going on here? Or what do different interpretations say is actually happening here? Or even, I've discovered something that's sort of new, puzzling thing in quantum mechanics. What does that suggest about the foundations of quantum theory itself? I would argue that because most physicists don't think in this way, hopefully doing that will lead you to do your physics in a different way and discover things that other people won't. So I hope that you'll do that. OK, thanks. That's it. If anyone has any questions.